Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting.
Good morning. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us for hour number two of the program. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour, we go to the Focus 580 archives for a previously broadcast program, one that we first aired in May. So as you listen, do keep in mind that during this hour, we will not take calls. In 1820, Congress passed a law declaring that any American citizen on the crew of a ship in the business of buying or selling human beings would be judged a pirate and they would be sentenced to death. Only one person was ever convicted and suffered the full penalty of this law. His name was Nathaniel Gordon, and he was hanged in 1862, 3 years before the end of the Civil War. This was at the point where this law had been on the books for 42 years. He was the first and the only person ever to be executed under this law. The question this morning we'll ask is, who was Nathaniel Gordon? And why was it that he was executed? And why was it that he was the only person to have been executed for trading in slaves? That is the subject of a newly published book, which is entitled Hanging Captain Gordon, The Life and Trial of an American Slave Trader. It is published by Atria Books, which is a division of Simon & Schuster, and it is by our guest this morning, Ron Sudalter. He's an educator and lay historian. He has taught American history. He's also worked as a museum curator, among other things. And he's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about this story. Mr. Sudalter, hello.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me on.
Well, really, we appreciate you talking with us. This is the kind of program that is one of the things that we like, and that is to get into a bit of history that I expect probably for most, if not almost everybody listening, will be completely new. This will be something that they had never heard of before.
Well, it is a remote story, that's for sure.
And this is something that it sounds as if you, when you were a student, you were in college, just literally you stumbled across it, or perhaps just stumbled across the name, and you thought, well, gee, this is interesting. I'd like to know some more about this. And eventually you delved into the story more and more, and the ultimate result is that you have put together this book about it.
Mm-hmm. There was virtually nothing written about Captain Nathaniel Gordon back in the mid-late 60s when I came across the story. And the drama of it, the unusual nature of it, made me to think that I would one day write the book about it. And at that time, I went into the primary source material via microfilm and found newspaper accounts from the period, you know, the early 1860s. And it was just fascinating, just a captivating story.
Well, perhaps you could talk a little bit to start about this 1820 law and why it was passed and what the intent of Congress was.
Well, actually, David, it was the last in a series of laws passed by Congress beginning in 1794 during the Washington administration, aimed at stopping the slave trade. Now, not slavery as an institution, mind you, but the slave trade. In those days, they made a clear distinction between slavery as a time-worn and benevolent institution and the actual trade of dealing in slaves, which they found horrific, as they put it. It simply amounted to the South feeling they had enough slaves. And they were aware of what had happened in Haiti a few years earlier when the slaves took over the island. There were sporadic uprisings across the South, which they put down quickly and brutally. But they were very much afraid that the black population, both slave and free black, were going to grow to outnumber that of the whites and ultimately create a problem for them. And in fact, the black population in the South did grow at a faster rate than that of whites. And so both North and South passed these laws almost unanimously, outlawing trafficking in slaves from Africa. And now this in no way outlawed dealing in slaves within the country itself. You were still perfectly within your legal rights to sell a slave from, say, Virginia to Louisiana, but not to board a ship and carry slaves from Africa either to this or other countries.
When Nathaniel Gordon set off on this trip to go to, he first went to Havana, mm-hmm. to Cuba to pick up the ship, and
right.
then to go from Cuba to Africa to take on his human cargo. When he did this, This was not the first time he had done this. He had made several of these trips before.
That is correct. This was his fourth voyage, and Gordon was the fourth generation in a family of sea captains from Portland, Maine. His family had actually come here in 1621, so it was an old, respectable family. He just chose to make his living in this way, and he had had three voyages before. And as I say, slaves were not coming into the United States in those days, so the voyages would be to either Cuba or Brazil. And this was to be his fourth. He picked up a load of 897 Africans, half of whom were children. He crammed them below decks in a very small ship, so tightly that they were sitting one in another's lap, and he set sail back for Havana. By sheer chance, he was captured at sea by a ship of the United States African Squadron, which was nowhere nearly as impressive as the name would indicate. And he was taken back to New York City for trial in federal court. Now, this was August of 1860, David. And he really had very little to worry about at the time, because New York then and for years before had been the epicenter of the slave trade in the United States. It had financed, fitted out, and shipped forth more slaving voyages than any other port, north or south. And slavers who were by sheer chance, and they were very few, brought into federal court were either given a slap on the wrist or let go. Mm-hmm. Now, the law that you mentioned was passed in 1820, and here it's 1860. So in 40 years, none of the thousands upon thousands of American sailors and captains to go from here to Africa and load their ships with slaves was ever convicted of the Piracy Act and condemned to die. Mm-hmm. So Gordon understandably felt he had nothing to worry about. The president was Buchanan. And Buchanan had gone on public record to say he would never hang a slave trader. And the prosecutor in New York, whose name was Roosevelt, had absolutely no desire to bring a slaver to the gallows.
Yeah, so that's an important point, is when he set off for this, his fourth slave voyage, he would have had, it would have been the furthest thing from his mind that somehow he would have been captured, arrested, put on trial, and find himself facing execution.
Absolutely.
It wouldn't have even have entered his mind.
Absolutely. This would have been the farthest thing from his worries.
Our guest is Ron Sudhalter, and his book
I have trouble with it too.
Hanging Captain Gordon, The Life and Trial of an American Slave Trader. It is just recently out. It's published by Altria. Boy, I'm not reading very well this morning, am I? Maybe I should get my glasses checked. You certainly could find it in the bookstore. Questions are welcome too. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We explained a little bit that what happens here is that he went from the United States to Havana, to Cuba,
right.
And there he would pick up the ship.
He took over a ship called the Erie. It mm-hmm. was a ship of only 122 feet, and he outfitted the ship for a slaving voyage. He managed to crew the vessel, and he loaded the hold with supplies which were commensurate with a slaving voyage, and that meant huge copper pots, grain to feed the slaves. But most importantly, it consisted of his trade goods, which in this case was whiskey. He had 150 hogsheads of whiskey to trade for slaves.
So the officials there in Havana, the Spanish officials and also the representative there of the American government, had every reason to believe that that is indeed what he was doing, that his intent was to go there and to take on slaves and to then bring them back. So they knew perfectly well what he was about.
Yeah, the U.S. Consul General in Havana actually went on record to say that virtually every American vessel sailing forth from Havana was after slaves in Africa. So it was no surprise to anyone. The Spanish customs house was paid off, and the American customs house was told not to meddle with American merchant seamen, and that included slavers.
But it seems in this particular case, and I hope I get this detail. I have this detail right. That the American representative there in Havana gave the government a heads up about Nathaniel Gordon in particular.
Yes, for some reason, which none of us can figure out, the U.S. Consul General, who was very much pro-slavery and ended up working for the Confederacy after the Civil War broke out, found it to send a warning, a heads-up, as you say, to the State Department, to the Department of the Navy, saying that this man, Nathaniel Gordon, was off on a slaving expedition. And he also warned a ship of the naval squadron to be on the alert for this guy. Now, nobody seems to be able to figure out what it was about Gordon that had this man, you know, do this uncharacteristic thing.
Mm-hmm. The suggestion is, or maybe your thought is, that just there was something about Captain Gordon that was just unpleasant, and the guy just... He just didn't like him. Something about the guy he didn't like.
Maybe, but you know, would that have been enough reason to warn the government that this man was off on a slaving expedition? I would tend to venture the guess that no slaving captains were your most delightful dinner companions. So there might have been something about Gordon that just took him a step further. Hmm. But nobody knows. The fact is, though, that warnings did go out.
So Gordon goes, he gets the slaves, he's starting to come back, mm-hmm. and then he is apprehended by the Navy. Even at that point, I guess we talked about the fact that when he set out, the thought that he could find himself sentenced to die would be the first thing from his mind. Even at that point where he was apprehended, would he have been worried?
No, absolutely not. Occasionally, slavers were apprehended and brought back for trial, and it was more for show than anything else. The government had no interest in hanging slave traders. When he was brought back to New York, David, he was put in the Eldridge Street Jail, which was really less a minimum security prison than kind of a low-rent hotel, and by paying the corrupt U.S. Marshal $50 in silver, he was allowed to roam the town and come back the next day. He entertained for his family and friends in his cell, and as the later U.S. Marshal, who eventually took over his case, put it, Gordon felt less like a felon than a gentleman out of his latitude. In other words, he was more imposed upon, he felt, than really under serious arrest.
Right. Well, that certainly represented what would have been... maybe the more common attitude, particularly in New York, as it was an important place for the slave trade. The man who was the marshal there certainly was not opposed to slavery. The man who was the district attorney was disinclined, to say the least, to try Gordon. And he apparently felt that even Gordon was put on trial and convicted, that the president mm-hmm. would, Mr. Buchanan, would pardon him. So
yeah.
It seemed like the entire, at least initially when Gordon was brought back and he was charged, the entire system, all the cards in a way, seemed to be stacked in his favor.
That's absolutely correct, David. Absolutely. The prosecutor had actually publicly stated that even if this man were convicted, the president would pardon him.
First, initially, though, the first prosecutor, that would have been Mr.
James Roosevelt,
mm-hmm. Offered a plea bargain. He apparently said to Gordon, look, if you give up your backers...
Yeah, name names and we'll let you cop,
to a lesser charge. And
right.
that, there was great public outcry against that.
Yeah, well, what happened was he went public with this offer. And at this time, a lot of the newspapers in New York had really had it with the slave trade, with the corruption in government, and with the very lackadaisical attitude on the parts of Buchanan, Roosevelt, and others of their ilk. And Henry Raymond of the New York Times went ballistic, and he published an amazingly acidic editorial in which he really took Roosevelt to task. Now, at this point, Gordon and his attorney thought, well, perhaps we should take advantage of this offer and just get the gallows out of the question entirely. But by this time, Roosevelt was so embarrassed publicly that he backed off and said, you know, I'm rescinding my offer.
Yeah. There apparently even would have been a point, we were talking about the fact that that Gordon had paid off the marshal so that essentially he could be free at least during the daytime, and this was not a particularly taxing incarceration from him, that if Gordon had the hint, any inkling of what would happen to him, he could have run.
He could have walked out the door and never come back. He was clearly in a place at a time that would not have been unsympathetic with his leaving town. And in fact, many slaving captains who found themselves under arrest, I mean, many of the few, I should say, chose to do exactly that, take what they'd call leg bail. In other words, just leave. They'd either pay bail or pay to get out of jail, or just go through the window and be gone. And it happened time and again. Ironically, the slave ship itself would be condemned in court, while the crew and captains would be either let go or simply escape. It was common practice.
Just one more here, further step in the story, and then I have a caller. I promise I'm not going to make that person wait forever. But the change in Captain Gordon's fortune comes because of political change. There was an election, and the power passed from the Democrats to the Republicans.
Right.
So now we have a new marshal.
A brand new heroic marshal, a tremendously aggressive young prosecutor, and a president in the White House in the person of Abraham Lincoln, who had absolutely no intention in the world of overlooking a slave trade conviction.
And did the new prosecutor, this was a man named Edward Delafield Smith,
right,
who was certainly had different feelings about slavery and about the law on slavery than his predecessor. He chose really to pursue this. He wanted to have a conviction. Did this have to do with his attitudes about slavery, or was it more the fact that he said, look, this is the law. This man broke the law, and it's important that the law is enforced?
Well, it's a very good question, David. Delafield Smith, although we would love to see him as the man on the white horse who came in as an abolitionist hating slavery, really didn't hate slavery. As a matter of fact, he told the jury that his best friends were in South Carolina with the Confederacy, and he couldn't see them, that he didn't share his fellow Republicans' desire for abolition or for equality, but that he felt this was a law, the slave trade law, that violated all concepts of humanity, and most importantly, it was the law, and as such, it needed to be enforced.
We have a call. Let's talk with them. In Indiana, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Well, while I was listening, it's answered a number of questions that were in my mind, so I'll come up with one of the ones that popped in, and that's the, I guess, first thing that popped in my mind when you talked about that law against bringing in slaves from Africa, mm-hmm. It's, you know, almost like us putting the skids on certain things from other countries, so we'll protect, you know, for protection purposes. I wonder if you'd speak about that, the economic aspects of all this, because, you know, normally you try to find something general that covers all the cases, and every time you come up with something that I've been listening to, you know, there's something counter that. And so I just sort of wondering maybe the best way to get at it, or perhaps the only way you could get at it, certainly quantitatively, would just be it's all economics, and if the New York people want slave captains there to bring in monies and spend money and all that kind of stuff, and then we're going to turn the eye. I wonder if any of that's involved in all this thing.
You're absolutely right. It's all about economics. It's all about money. I mean, from the actual slave trade itself, what would allow a man or men to so dismally abuse their fellow creatures other than greed? It was entirely greed. New York, which was called the most southern of all northern cities, had as its biggest client the southern slave markets and the southern plantations. It was money from first to last, and the reason Gordon did what he did was money. The reason nobody bothered to push the slave trade laws was money. It was all about economy. It was all about the dollar.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that often is missed, and that is the role that economic interests in the North played in perpetuating slavery.
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, there is a book that came out last year called Complicity, and I'm very good friends with one of the three authors, and it deals with just that, David. It deals with how the North basically promoted and profited from slavery. It's an excellent book.
When the Erie was taken by the U.S. Navy and Gordon was captured, so the ship was captured, he was captured in the crew, what happened to those slaves that were there on the Erie?
With a Navy skeleton crew, the 897 slaves were sailed for 2 weeks to Liberia, which was the American free black colony on the coast of Africa. It took 2 weeks to get there, and in those 2 weeks, 37 of the slaves died and were thrown over the side and were never made it to Monrovia, which was the capital.
Let's talk with another caller here. Let's go to someone listening in Chicago. That's next on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm a little late, so if I ask this question again, I'm terribly sorry. But is it true, just before the Civil War started, that the South was talking about reviving the African slave trade, and that President Lincoln was definitely opposed to that, and he also wanted laws protecting freedmen because some of the hunters, the bounty hunters, whose job it was to hunt down a fugitive slave, would just kidnap some guy out of Chicago or New York or Massachusetts and take him south? Did he want to protection against that?
It's an interesting question. In fact, the South's interest in the slave market had grown over the course of the 1840s and 50s, and there was a very brief and intense revival of the slave trade coming out of the South, and some of the ships actually did bring slaves there. As far as Lincoln's position was concerned, he said that he would in no way interfere with the institution of slavery as it existed, but was opposed to its expansion into the territories, and that was the Republican Party position. As far as the slave trade went, Lincoln never made any bones about the fact that it was prohibited by the Constitution, and as such, he opposed it.
It's also true, isn't it, that in 1862 he met with what then would be civil rights leaders and suggested that
Frederick Douglass?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And suggested that they return, all free slaves be returned to Liberia or wherever it was, New Grenada. Of course, the North was losing the war and morale was low, but he later changed his mind, right?
I'm sorry, would you do that question again?
Yes, isn't it a fact that in 1862, President Lincoln met with Frederick Douglass and other leaders and suggested that it might be a good idea to return all of the slaves to places like Liberia or New Grenada?
Yeah, at one point, Lincoln not only wanted to return slaves, but he wanted also free blacks and manumitted blacks out of the country to be placed in Liberia. It was a position that he eventually recanted, but it was not an unusual position. There was an organization called the American Colonization Society that set up in 1816 and set about getting as many blacks out of the country as they could. And they did that by setting up a colony on the coast of Africa, as I say, called Liberia. And some very major people were founders and members of that, including President Monroe, hence the name Monrovia for the capital city.
Right. In fact, if you look at white separatist groups today, they use that as an example of trying to claim that Lincoln mirrored their point of view, which, in fact, he did not.
Well, I think Lincoln grew tremendously from when he was campaigning to when he'd been president for a while, both in terms of his view of African Americans and his view of slavery itself.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in 1862 he said that, but then 3 years later when the war ended, he said, maybe we can give the vote to all of the freedmen who fought in our union and made this victory possible.
Yeah, I think his social view broadened tremendously. Part of the problem is people say, well, Lincoln said this or Lincoln did that without allowing for growth and development, also without allowing for the fact that Lincoln was a politician. And often he said things, not necessarily that he didn't believe, but he said things in such a way that were, geared to get him the vote and the popular support.
Well, you know, it's interesting that years later, a certain politician, Texas politician in 1956, said, I am not and do not expect to ever be for any civil rights legislation. And 8 years later, he signed the Civil Rights Bill.
He did indeed, yes.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is Ron Sudalter. He is the author of the book, Hanging Captain Gordon, The Life and Trial of an American Slave trader. Atria Books is the publisher. It's a division of Simon & Schuster. And it tells the story of this man, Nathaniel Gordon, who was the only slave trader ever convicted under an 1820 law passed by Congress declaring that trafficking in human beings was an act of piracy and would be punishable by death. That law had been on the books at the time that Nathaniel Gordon was executed. That law had been on the books for 42 years, and he was the first and only person ever to suffer the maximum penalty. The book, Hanging Captain Gordon, tells that story. Questions here on the show are welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana listeners, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's someone in Champaign County. We'll talk with them next. Line one.
Yeah,
hello.
Put him up on the ladder. Yeah.
Hello?
But it looks nice. It makes the house look bigger.
I can't hear.
I think the caller was momentarily distracted there. We'll see if we can get back to them. We talked about the fact that initially when Gordon was arrested and charged, there was one president, there was one DA, there was one marshal, all with one set of attitudes, and then things really changed. So now we have a prosecutor who's really interested in prosecution. There is a trial, but interestingly enough, we get a hung jury.
Yes,
and there's
did.
A mistrial.
Uh-huh. That's correct.
And the suggestion is that somehow maybe somebody got to the jury?
Yeah, the suspicion on the part of both the prosecutor and the marshal was that the jury had been bribed. Now, sometimes that was the practice, David, but sometimes that wasn't even necessary because very few American juries, especially in New York City, which was predominantly Democrat and pro-Southern, had it in them to sentence an American to hang whose crime had been taking Africans to a foreign country, when, as I say, it was perfectly legal to traffic in slaves within the country itself.
Hmm. There, just now, to round out the story, though, they had a first trial. There was a hung jury. There was a mistrial. Then there was a second trial. So apparently for Mr. Smith, Delafield Smith, it was important enough for him to try to secure a conviction that he decided to try Gordon again?
Oh, absolutely. Gordon was his demon. He decided that Gordon would be the one. All the conditions were in place that were required legally to find a man guilty of trafficking in slaves and to hang him. And he was determined to go out of his way, and had helping him, the new U.S. Marshal, who was an amazing man by the name of Robert Murray, to go out of his way to procure enough witnesses to make sure that a jury had absolutely no alternative but to find this man guilty. And so what he did was he had Murray's deputies as well as detectives comb the northern waterfronts and find sailors from the Erie who would come to New York and testify as exactly what happened on board that ship.
Also, though, he took some steps to try to make sure that there would be no jury tampering?
Yes, he did. This was a rare case because he actually sequestered the jury, and the marshal and his deputies made sure that they went nowhere, talked to no one, and stayed together until the 3 days of the trial were over and the verdict was considered and delivered.
Right. Let's see if we can get back to our Champaign County caller here, line number one. Hello. Their caller there on line one.
Hello?
Yes. Yeah, we got you. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
I wanted to go back to Lincoln again. I'm sorry. I know this is sententious of me, but in the African-American community, there's a book called Forced into Glory, written by a guy who lives in Chicago, that has stuff about Lincoln that I've never read anywhere else, including the fact that the allegation, which he has some documentation on, that Lincoln sort of illegally, something we're familiar with now, without appropriate appropriations, kept open an office called the Negro Removal Office, which was sort of parallel to the Indian Removal Act, and that it actually had one ill-fated attempt to ship freed or slaves, ex-slaves, back to Liberia, and they lost, I think, something like 50%, actually ran into a woman whose lineage went back to that ill-fated trip to Liberia. Mm. So that, and it was fairly late in his presidency, too, that he kept this Negro Removal Office open, so that the allegation in this book is that it was, you know, he allowed for political, false statements, as you pointed out. But just the real impression is that exactly that Lincoln was forced into glory, that he was not part of the radical Republican part. And I just wondered, in your looking at the original documentation, all the newspapers of that day, whether you read anything about ill-fated trips back to Liberia and that whole reality.
I've not read the book Forced into Glory, but it's I have to tell you that the title alone, when referring to Abraham Lincoln, I find to be just a little edgy. I think if any man, and I'll say this without qualification, if any man in our history deserved glory for making his way through an impossibly dense and conflicted situation and bringing us as a nation through to the other end, it's Abraham Lincoln. I don't say that to indicate that he was in any way or shape perfect. I think his racial views reflected the racial views of the time. I don't believe he ever believed in racial equality. He actually stated that blacks should never hold public office. And yet I think what he did, in spite of both his views and the views of and the popular views of the time, was absolutely phenomenal given what he had to work with and the state of the country at the time.
Well, this idea of presentism, which is such a ridiculous formulation anyway, there were radical Republicans that wanted full equality at the time. So the idea that there was nobody.
No. I'm not saying there was nobody. I'm saying that the common, the prevalent view at the time, in no way was rampant for equality.
Well, I'm just only arguing that this... it isn't that different today. I mean, we have some communities right in this area that had horns that blew, so that the so-called sundown towns. So I think the whole argument about how much different it was then, and the book is very impressive. It really marshals a lot of stuff. It's as you say, it's an edgy title, and I think it's. But this idea that he kept open this Negro Removal Office. With the intention of, you know, and apparently he might have opposed the importation of slaves just on the argument that he was making, which was that we want to keep the population down and we want to ship more, as many back as we can.
Well, I think he was against the importation of slaves for any number of defensible reasons. But if he was inclined, and he was as I say at the early part of his presidency, to rid the country of as many African Americans as possible, I think it was more for expediency than for personal preference.
Mm. Well, there's a Freudian term of multi-determination, which everything is
everything's related. Yeah, no, that's a good point.
All right, I thank you.
Well,
thanks
for the call. Others are welcome. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that when Gordon was first arrested and he was brought back to New York, that the district attorney there was really disinclined to put him on trial.
Yes.
And felt that even if he was tried and convicted, that the president at the time, James Buchanan, who had said he was not about to hang anybody for slaving, the DA there, Mr. Roosevelt in New York, felt, well, even if I get a conviction, this man's going to be pardoned. So things changed a lot when there was another district attorney and there was another president. Mm-hmm. But yet, at the same time, the people who defended Gordon made a petition to the president, Abraham Lincoln, for a pardon for Captain Gordon.
Yeah, this is the part in which Lincoln plays a very major role, David. After the conviction, now bear in mind that this was federal court, and the only way there could be an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court was if both judges on the case, if the judges disagreed. And in the Gordon case, both judges agreed, so the Supreme Court said that they were not interested in reviewing the case, that there was really no ground for an appeal. And the justice who said that, Chief Justice Roger Taney, was the one who made himself very unpopular with the Dred Scott decision. So the only outlet for an appeal at that time was to the chief executive. It was to Lincoln himself. And at that point, Lincoln was brought in. He was appealed to both in letter form and personally by the defense attorney, who was a very powerful attorney, former judge by the name of Gilbert Dean, and also by Delafield Smith. They both went to Washington and met with Lincoln to pressure him in their own preferred directions. Lincoln's, or rather Gordon's wife and mother, went to visit Lincoln in the White House, and he refused to see them. So they saw Mary Lincoln, and Mrs. Gordon presented Mary Lincoln with a poem she'd written begging her to impose her influence on her husband, but Lincoln refused to discuss it, refused to allow for a commutation. And thousands upon thousands of signatures on petitions came from all over the North, begging Lincoln to at least give this man life imprisonment. Don't make him the victim of a law that had been a dead letter for over four decades. And the pressure, as I say, was tremendous, not just from the common citizen or from the slaving quarters, but also from office holders, from officers in the army, friends of Lincoln. Lincoln's one of Lincoln's best friends asked him to consider, and he refused.
Gordon was executed, and on the eve of his execution, he had some public comments about his situation and what was happening to him, and what had happened to him, and what would.
Right.
And it was very clear that he felt an injustice had been done to him.
Absolutely.
And that he had not done anything wrong. There's a letter was published that he wrote, addressed mm-hmm. to the general public, in which he writes, "I have no feeling that I have done any wrong action.
Right.
I die perfectly easy so far as that is concerned." He writes, "I have not injured any man knowingly through the whole course of my life."
Right. He said that in the letters that he wrote. He also said it on the gallows, just before going to the gallows, in his last speech. He said, "I've never knowingly harmed another human being." When asked about the slaves who died on their way to Liberia on the Erie, he said that it wasn't his fault. It was the inexperience of the Navy that caused it. The fact that hundreds of slaves had died on his previous voyages didn't compute as far as Gordon was concerned, so we're left with only one conclusion, David, and that is he simply did not consider them human beings, which is tragic in the extreme. He felt that he was being made an example of, which in fact he was, and that Delafield Smith had promised him clemency if the jury found him guilty, which in fact Smith had not done. So Gordon went to his death unrepentant and defiant, and never acknowledging the gravity of his crimes.
Did the prosecution of Nathaniel Gordon and his execution do anything for the political career of Delafield Smith?
It's an interesting question. Delafield Smith was after making three examples as far as the slave trade went in New York. One was to convict and hang a slave captain. Another was to convict the men who outfitted the ships. Another was to convict a man who would bail out the ships when they were captured so that they could go to sea once more. And he managed to get convictions on all three counts. But in the last two, Lincoln, in effect, pardoned the convicted men. So his example was Gordon. And did it affect him politically? I don't know that it did. He actually wrote a little treatise on, you know, how to make jury addresses in slave trade cases. But ultimately, he went to private practice once again. I think the big question was, did the conviction of Gordon have an impact on ending the slave trade? And in that regard, it's a more complicated question. I think it did in New York City. A lot of the people involved in slaving in New York City left the city and went to other northern ports, New Haven, Boston, Newport, Rhode Island, and set up shop there. But they felt that New York City was an unhealthy place to be. Did it end the slave trade? No, clearly not. it would have ended anyway, and it was ending because the Civil War closed off the southern ports. Lincoln eventually used Gordon's hanging as a springboard for a treaty with England, which finally allowed English ships to board our own and capture our slavers. And the ports of Brazil were closed off by Brazil itself, and the port of Havana was being patrolled by British ships. So there was really no market anymore. So if you want to suggest that Gordon's death was timely, it was more than timely. If you want to ask, did it end the slave trade? Clearly not. Mm.
But no one after Gordon suffered the same penalty.
No. In fact, there was a handful of slaving captains arrested and brought to trial in New York after Gordon, and actually before, during, and after Gordon's travails, and none of them was hanged. In fact, Gordon's first and second mates, who were tried 2 weeks after his execution and by all rights should have been afforded the same penalty, were simply let go with a minor sentence and a fine of $1 each. Delafield Smith set out to make his example, and he did. He wasn't after hanging every slave trader.
We have about 10 minutes, maybe a little bit more, again, in this part of Focus 580. Ron Sudalter is our guest. His book is Hanging Captain Gordon, The Life and Trial of an American Slave Trader. Atria Books is the publisher. It's out there in the bookstore now. I mentioned it back at the beginning of the program that doing a show like this is one of the things that we like, because it shines some light in a corner of American history that for a lot of people will be completely new, something that they'd not heard of before. What is it that you would like to you'd like people to take away from this story?
Well, it's I'd answer that on three levels. One is it's a good story. The Gordon story is a good and it's an important story on its own merits. But also on a second level, it shows how over the course of the entire first two-thirds of the 19th century, our own government did virtually nothing to enforce our laws to end the slave trade, and how had they done so, the horrible crime of slave trading could have been put an end to long before the Civil War. I'm not speaking of the institution of slavery, David. I'm speaking of the slave trade itself. And thirdly, the last chapter in the book addresses the subject of modern-day slave trafficking, human trafficking in America, and treats it as the legacy of such 19th-century slavers as Nathaniel Gordon. And hopefully that message, what's going on in America today, will sound a bugle to the Americans who read this book and let them know that we are in it again in a much more seditious sort of a way, a much more hidden way, a much more insidious sort of a slave traffic than we ever suffered from before, especially because most Americans don't even know it exists.
What happened to Gordon's family after he was executed?
Ah, that's a good question. His son, young Nathaniel, was 5 at the time of his father's death, and he eventually made his way back to Portland as a young man and got in the marine salvage business as a hard hat diver and developed a very good and honorable reputation. Gordon's widow, a beautiful young woman named Elizabeth, who was only 22 at the time, disappeared as far as I knew. When I finished this book, after knowing of this story for over 40 years, I had no idea what had happened to Elizabeth. And then about 2 months ago, I got an email from a woman who said that she was the great-great-granddaughter of Nathaniel Gordon. And by sheer coincidence, she came down to my town for a social function, and I met and spoke with her a few weeks ago, and I found out what happened to Gordon's widow. And she stayed in the New York area. She stayed in Queens, never left it. She remarried another sea captain, had 4 more children by him. He died relatively young as well. She did not have much luck with sea captains or husbands. And she died in 1911 at the age of around 72, I think, although with every 10-year census, she made herself a year or two younger. So it's, it's hard to tell exactly how old she was, but she was around 72.
Another caller here, someone in Urbana, here where we are, line 1. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering, Was this a something that was followed all across the country, and what was its timing relative to the beginning of the Civil War? Was it something like the Harper's Ferry that really kind of, you know, made the country feel, you know, even more divided about slavery?
Actually, when Gordon was arrested in August of 1860, we still were not in Civil War. It happened within a month or two after Gordon's indictment, and between that and the national election, bringing in the Republicans and Abraham Lincoln, it became less a focus on Gordon than a shift in his fate. And all the while Gordon was going to trial, no one in the city, the state, or the country had any reason to suspect that the resolution of his trial was going to be any different than any other sea captain's or any other slaving captain. And only when it became clear that Lincoln had no intention of reprieving or pardoning Gordon did the case gain some notoriety, so that by the time of Gordon's actual execution, newspapers, mostly throughout the East and the North, had articles in it saying that we finally done this. The only mention of it I have been able to find in a Southern newspaper, and by this time the Civil War was a little over a year old, was in the Richmond Inquirer, which simply stated it as fact. It did not editorialize. It said Nathaniel Gordon, Captain Nathaniel Gordon, was executed as a slave, you know, as a slave trader in New York City on February 21, 1862. Hmm. And that was it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
You betcha.
Yeah, I would imagine that some, you would expect that some people might seize on him and his case as and would make him, want to make him a hero or make him a martyr somehow. It sounds more like people just wanted to almost forget that he had ever been.
I think the only one who thought himself as a martyr was Nathaniel
Green himself. Yeah,
yeah, and he, as he said on the gallows, I suppose John Brown must be avenged. So he saw his death as payback for the hanging of John Brown, which was a real stretch. No, I think the fact that he was a slave trader made him a very unappetizing subject for martyrdom. In those days, David, often a victim of an execution, a pirate especially, would have broadside ballads written about him. The man who was executed a year before Gordon, who was a pirate, had such a ballad written about him. It's called Hicks the Pirate. And there was nothing written about Gordon. I think the fact that slave traders were so unappetizing led to his death being ignominious, no matter who looked at it.
Would other people, do you think, have other people who were in that same business looked at what happened to Gordon and think that could be me, or would they just think, well, this guy, it was just a really serious case of bad luck?
I think the latter. There was actually a brief flurry of slaving captains sailing to the Congo, and after Gordon's execution, trying to get it all in before before the end of the trade itself. So, no, I don't think his death discouraged slave trading so much as slave trading was dying itself, as I said, dying a natural death.
You talked a little bit earlier about the issue of trafficking in human beings today,
yes,
which still goes on. It is a serious international
epidemic in the world
product,
and in this
problem. And yeah, although it's not chattel slavery mostly, I think, as in this particular case, it's the character is a little bit different, but it's certainly a pernicious and now global kind of, it's become globalized just like other aspects of the economy has become.
Well, here's a statistic for you. It's estimated that there are in the world today over 27 million people in bondage. Now, that's over twice the number of people that were taken in chains from Africa during the entire 350 years of the Atlantic slave trade. And our own government estimates that somewhere between 15 and 20,000 a year are trafficked into this country. And not just sex trafficking and prostitution, but also agricultural workers, domestics, house slaves. We're finding them, or not finding them, in all 50 states, working in sweatshops, factories, restaurants, laundries. Anywhere cheap labor thrives, people are enslaved. And it is truly slavery, David. I mean, this isn't just a form of people working for a low wage for somebody they don't like. They're bought and sold. They're kept under the threat and reality of real violence, and they're not allowed to leave.
And they're, what's crushingly sad about it is that they are treated as being some kind of disposable commodity, because the people who know that there are always more people that could take that person's place, and that it's extraordinarily cheap, and in many cases the people are simply in some of the cases that these workers, these slaves, they're just used up. And when they're used up, then you just literally throw them away, and then you get more. You just let them die.
Well, that's one of the big differences between the slavery of now and the slavery of the old plantation days. In those days, a slave would cost what in today's dollars would be around $40,000. And he was a public slave. In other words, the owner had him as a form of property, of status. Nowadays, you can buy a slave for under $100, and they're kept hidden, which is why it is such an insidious thing today. And it's often cheaper just to let someone die and replace him or her than it is to provide medicine or medical attention or the right kind of care.
We are at the point here, I think, that we're going to have to finish up again for people who would like to read this story, and it is an interesting story.
Thank you.
I would suggest you look for the book, and again, the title, Hanging Captain Gordon, and it's published by Atria by our guest Ron Sudalter, and you certainly could find it out in the bookstore right now. Mr. Sudalter, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, David, it has been a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
And you've been listening to a Focus 580 program from our archive. The show was first broadcast on the 4th of May of this year. Many past Focus shows, also interviews from the Afternoon Magazine, a lot of our local production is available on the website. It's there for you to listen to anytime you like. Just go and take a look. It's WILL.UIUC.EDU. The program made possible this morning in part by a grant from Body Work Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana. Since 1982, Body Work Associates has now opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. Tomorrow morning on the program in the 10 o'clock hour, we have something of a practical nature, we hope. Phil Nixon will be here. He's an extension entomologist from the U of I. Every once in a while he's here, and we give you a chance to ask about insect problems, either in the home or in the yard. If you got a problem, he can tell you what to do about it. Then in the second hour, we'll talk with Mitch Weiss. He now works at the Charlotte Observer newspaper, but at one point he was a reporter for the Toledo Blade, and he's one of two reporters that won a Pulitzer Prize for their work on the Tiger Force. This was a fighting unit from the Vietnam War that had been charged with war crimes before the time of My Lai. Now they've written a book about it, which is titled Tiger Force, A True Story of Men and War, and you can hear that tomorrow at 11. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. And right now, we hope you'll stay tuned, because up next is the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, an interview from the archive. Our guest back on June 7th, Cecily Ross. She is the author of Love in the Time of Cholesterol, a memoir. The book is the story of how she and her husband learned to adjust to life after his heart attack and heart bypass surgery. That's coming up this afternoon at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. July wheat in Kansas trading at 5.08 in fast track trade. That up 5. At the Chicago Board of Trade, July wheat is trading at 3.86 and a half, up 2 and a quarter. September 4.04 and a quarter. Make that 4.04 and three quarters. Latest tick up 2 and three quarters. July corn 2.38 and three quarters, down 4 and a half. September 2.49 and a quarter, down 4 and a quarter. December 2.64 and a quarter, down 4 and a quarter. March 2.75 and three quarters, down 4. July soybeans 5.97, down 4 and a half. August 6.03 and a half, down 5. September 6.11, down 4 and three quarters. November 6.24 and a quarter, down 5.